This evening's discussion, as you know, will center on the objectivist theory of volition. It will be concerned with elaborating the principle that man is a being of volitional consciousness. This theory is central and basic both to objectivist philosophy and to objectivist psychology. What is meant by the statement that man is a being of volitional consciousness? Well, I will ask you first of all to consider the following. In a previous lecture, I have discussed the fact that there are three basic cognitive units or forms of awareness that characterize man's consciousness: sensations, perceptions, conceptions. And I have discussed the fact that the process of integrating individual disparate sensations into percepts is done automatically by the nervous system and the brain. That is, sensations flow into the organism. These are automatically integrated and related, enabling man to be aware of reality perceptually. That is, to be aware of objects, of entities. I then discussed how man moves from the perceptual level of consciousness to the uniquely and distinctively human level, the conceptual level, by integrating his percepts into concepts, then integrating his concepts into still wider abstractions, and so forth. Now, the first level of abstractions or concepts, the awareness of such phenomena, let's say, as green or hard or soft, these also take place automatically and universally in any normal brain. That is, these most primitive of concepts, which are the building blocks of all subsequent thinking, these too appear to be integrated automatically by the brain. By that I mean, there's no way that a normal person could escape forming such fundamental primitive concepts as green, brown, red, hard, soft, etc. The category, in a word, of attributes which can only be defined ostensibly. In other words, that level of concepts which constitute, as it were, generalizations of direct sensory experiences, which are one step away from percepts. For example, if one looks at three different green objects and forms the concept green, well, here we deal with a very easy, very elementary, and just about inescapable kind of concept that no normal brain could escape forming. Beyond this level, however, the brain no longer produces concepts automatically. That is, as soon as you rise above this most primitive level of concepts into the genuine sphere of the conceptual faculty, in a word, as soon as the infant is functioning on the level where thinking can be said to have begun, we are no longer dealing with a cognitive process that functions automatically. Whether or not the infant, the young man, the adult, will think or not to think, this is an act of choice which he has to make. It is not a function which is forced upon him or determined or necessitated by his nature in the sense in which the integration of his sensations into percepts is automatic. Putting it another way, you have only to open your eyes and you cannot escape seeing objects and entities. That is automatic. But in order to think, you have to do something. You have to generate effort. You have to focus your minds. You have to choose to set the machinery in motion. You have to choose to seek to understand that which is not immediately given, that which is not self-evident, that which is not inescapably there in your immediate sensory experience, but rather that which you must reach by a process of conceptual reasoning. To quote from Galt's speech, quote, man is a being of volitional consciousness. Reason does not work automatically. Thinking is not a mechanical process. The connections of logic are not made by instinct. The function of your stomach, lungs, or heart is automatic. The function of your mind is not. In any hour and issue of your life, you are free to think or to evade that effort. But you are not free to escape from your nature, from the fact that reason is your means of survival, so that for you, who are a human being, the question to be or not to be is the question to think or not to think. Close quote. In this choice to think or not to think, to focus one's mind or not to focus it, to assume the responsibility of the conceptual level of consciousness or to evade it, and in this choice alone is man psychologically free. That choice, once made, does not continue to direct man's mind unceasingly thereafter, with no further effort required. Just as the state of full mental focus must be initiated volitionally, so it must be maintained volitionally. The choice to think must be reaffirmed in the face of every new issue and problem. The decision to be in focus yesterday will not compel man to be in focus today. The decision to be in focus about one question will not compel man to be in focus about another. The decision to pursue a certain value does not guarantee that man will exert the mental effort needed to achieve it. In any hour of his life, then, man is free to suspend the function of his consciousness, to abandon effort, and to let his mind drift in will-less passivity. Or he is free to maintain only a partial focus, grasping that which comes easily to his understanding and declining to struggle for that which does not. Now consider this concept of focusing the mind. It is a state and an operation which each one of you is able very easily to discern introspectively. You all know what it means to be in a state of kind of vague floating or dreaming, thinking about nothing, and then suddenly to attend to some particular issue, mentally to attend, to focus, to aim your cognitive faculty, as it were, in a certain direction. To say to yourself now, grasp this. Make this intelligible. Understand this. A simple example is one that you encounter every morning when you're waking up. You wake up and you're a bit drowsy and you feel as though your consciousness is rather splintered perhaps for a few seconds or minutes or hours. And at some point, presumably, you say, in effect, well now, what do I have to do today? And you begin to think over what is ahead of you this day and what you have to attend to. That's an act that you can catch, a very easy kind of act of focusing your mind, of making yourself fully conscious. There are many other examples which I shall discuss reflecting the same basic choice to think or not to think, to focus or not to focus. But in order to appreciate in a biological context this distinct human faculty, before proceeding with a further description of what the volitional faculty is and how it functions, I want to give it the following brief biological context. A basic characteristic of the actions of living organisms, of all living organisms, as distinguished from inanimate matter, is that the actions of living entities are goal-directed. That is, they are self-regulated action moving towards a certain end or goal. Now, obviously, when we deal with unconscious or more precisely non-conscious organisms like plants, we don't speak of the goal as something which the plant holds since it has no mind, but that we, looking at the outside, can see that there is a logic governing all of the actions of the plant or the tree, or the shrub. One can see a unifying principle at work. And we see that the principle of life is always an integrated series of complex actions taken in that direction which will promote the growth and the survival of the organism. For example, you all have seen the perhaps instance of a plant beginning to grow in the direction of the sunlight, and then perhaps a boulder rolls over part of it, and it begins to grow around the boulder, as though there is a clear principle directing it, and it has a certain highly limited ability to vary its motion or its direction to end up in the same place, that is, in a place where it will be in reach of the sun. Or we know of many experiments where scientists interfere with the normal processes of the growth of a tree, and within certain limits we see that the living organism has a certain flexibility to vary certain of its actions in order to end up with the same result. This is well known in biology, of course. You can observe it internally on the vegetative level of your own bodies. That is, a very complex series of actions go on constantly within your own bodies, all organized in an immensely complex way to add up to one result, namely the preservation of the life of the organism. The action is not random. It's highly structured, it's highly organized, and what you observe is that the life principle, whatever we may yet have to discover about it, the life principle possesses as its key characteristic this aspect of goal-directed, self-regulating action. All living organisms, however simple or however complex, exhibit it universally. That's entailed in the very nature of what it means to be alive. Now, observe the transition from a plant to an animal. What you observe is an increasing complexity in the type of self-regulation which becomes possible. On the vegetative level, or the plant level, you get an internal chemical, internal structural kind of regulatory activity. But you see a more complex expression of the principle of self-regulated action as soon as you enter the realm of conscious animals. Why? Because we observe that consciousness is the regulator of the action of the organism viewed as a total entity. What would be a simple example of this? Well, something very easy. Your cat or dog is walking across the room, and there's a carton in the middle of the living room. It sees it, and it walks around it. That's the simplest example of where consciousness is regulating and guiding the action which the animal is taking. The animal, of course, depends for its survival upon its sense of smell, and of course its sense of smell is one aspect of its consciousness. So we see animals guided by their sensations, which obviously carries implicitly in it our recognitions. An animal is guided by its form of consciousness. Now, an animal's consciousness is passive in that it can react to external stimuli, and according to how it reacts, being the passive recipient of messages coming in from the outside, it will, within limits, regulate the action which the animal will take accordingly. Animals are distinguished from plants, of course, by virtue of the fact that they can move, that they're not anchored to one spot, and their consciousness guides them in this process of motion. And so here, when you enter the animal realm, you observe a higher, more complex type of life organization and a more complex kind of self-regulated action. Now, when you deal with man, you deal not only with consciousness, but with a particular form or kind of consciousness to which we give the name mind. Man possesses a mind, a reasoning faculty, a capacity to think, to abstract, to conceptualize. And now you observe, with a corresponding increased complexity of life organization, a new kind, a new advance, a still more complex form of self-regulatory action, namely, a being who is able to regulate the action of his own consciousness. That is what it means to say that man is a being of volitional consciousness. Man can direct his consciousness. What do I mean when I say that? Well, most of you, or many of you, probably own pets, and that will help you to give a concrete sense of what I'm talking about. A pet hears a sound and it jerks his head in that direction. Animals are entirely dependent upon and tied to the cues in their sensory fields. They don't think up problems to solve. They don't say, what will I think about today? And they certainly don't say, I'd rather not think about that today. It's too upsetting. Their consciousnesses are passive reactors to the stimuli which they receive. But one of the important distinctive attributes of man's consciousness is that man has the power to regulate his own consciousness, to regulate its action, to in effect decide in what direction it will go. Putting it differently, to decide whether or not it will think, whether or not it will turn the conceptual level or focus on at all. The basic act of self-regulation possible to a human consciousness is to direct that consciousness aimed in the direction of being aware, of being optimally conscious, of seeking to understand that with which it is dealing, or to suspend conscious focus, to go out of focus, to induce an inner fog. That is the basic self-regulatory option which a man has over his own consciousness. Putting it differently, what man controls is the primary goal. What he directly and volitionally controls is the primary goal or end which his consciousness is to pursue. And there's only one basic choice. Either, in any given issue, a consciousness seeks to know, to grasp something, or it fails to, or evades the effort, or evades the responsibility of seeking to grasp. And this is another way of saying that man's basic choice is to think or not to think. Now let me concretize further what specifically this choice is and means. There are three fundamental expressions of the choice to think or not to think. Three different cardinal forms in which that issue presents itself to man. The first and the most general I have already indicated, namely, to focus, to seek to understand, or to remain in an internal state of fog, or to induce the state of inner fog. That is the basic fundamental choice, to focus or not to focus, to seek always to understand, to seek always to widen the range of one's awareness, to seek mentally to grow, to expand the reach of one's consciousness, or not to bother, or to say it's too much work, or it's too painful, or I don't want to know, it'll be inconvenient, or whatever the case may be. Another form in which this choice, this same choice, presents itself to man occurs any time he experiences a conflict or a clash between his mind and his emotions, or his reason and his feelings. That is, any time he finds that he should do something because it makes sense, but he doesn't want to, or he wants to do something, or desires something, or fears something, even though he knows it is wrong or irrational to do so. Then the question is, does he remain in mental focus? Does he preserve his conscious knowledge and consequently be guided by that? Or does he suspend his conscious knowledge? Does he render his conscious knowledge inoperative in order to drift under the passive sway of his feeling, emotion, or desire? And that, again, is the choice to think or not to think. If a man wants to do something which is irrational, he has to turn off his mind, turn off his critical faculty, suspend his consciousness, and shrink his awareness down to the fact that he wants it, period, and make himself blind to and unconscious of anything else, which means he has to go out of focus. He has to cease to think. The third basic form in which the choice to think or not to think presents itself to man is the issue between his consciousness and the consciousness of others, the issue between intellectual sovereignty or dependence. That is, will he seek with his own mind to understand that which is true, and when he has formed judgments, remain loyal to the best of his own honest understanding until and unless he has reason to revise his judgments? Or will he abdicate the responsibility of independent thinking, of independent judgment, and accept passively and uncritically the views and the judgments of other people instead? These, then, are the three fundamental forms in which man comes up against the question to think or not to think. This is the nature of the self-regulatory action which man performs with regard to his own consciousness. This is the nature of the control which one has over one's own consciousness. You see, in a certain sense, one's consciousness or mind is always doing something, even if only little random thoughts or feelings are flicking through it. Something is happening at all times. Life is always action in some sense. Now, the option or the choice then consists of determining or controlling or directing the goal which the action is to take. Let me give you a simple example. Suppose you come into this classroom tonight, and you're sitting and your mind is just floating and popping around from subject to subject, and let's say that it's not thinking about anything in particular. And then you look up and you see that the lecture's about to begin. And you tell yourself, in effect, well, now it's time to concentrate and pay attention if I'm to understand this lecture. Well, now, in that moment, a choice has to be made. You have to, in effect, decide, now I am going to set my intellectual machinery in a certain direction aimed at a certain goal, namely, the goal being to understand what Mr. Brandon has to say and to judge it. Now, for most of you, that process occurs so naturally that you're not even aware of it when it happens. And yet there was a moment for each one of you when you had to, in effect, aim your consciousness in the direction of the words I'm now saying and implicitly give yourself the order, grasp what he is saying. Now, let's take an imaginary example which will illustrate the three variants of the choice to think or not to think. Suppose I begin to speak and you, at a certain point, find that in order to understand, you have to maintain a very clear mental focus and you cannot doze off and just float for a minute, because if you do, you're going to lose the train of thought. And suppose you then say, well, it's just too hard, it's too much trouble, it's too much bother, thinking is such a chore, and you let yourself go out of focus. Well, that's one variant of the choice to think or not to think. Let's take another example. Suppose that you are focused and you are thinking along with me, but at a certain point, a certain connection falls into place in your mind. Suppose you're intelligent and you're thinking ahead of me. And at a certain point, you realize, well, if I get the direction of where Brandon is going, or what one of the implications of what he's saying would be, if indeed the choice to think or not to think is volitional, then that means that on those times when I acted irresponsibly, like a drunken driver without knowing what I was doing, it was my fault. A volitional irresponsibility is involved. Oh, God, that's an unpleasant thought. I don't like the implications of that line of thinking he's developing. I better get out of here. Well, you don't physically leave. You just put your mind out of focus. That is an example of the principle of reason versus feelings. What is it that matters most, to grasp whether it's true or false, or to be driven by how you happen to feel about what might be the results of it being true or false, respectively? Suppose that you pass both hurdles. You remain in focus, you're not afraid of using your mind, and you're not afraid of the consequences. But at a certain point, you remember that in college you were told by your sociology teacher that everybody agrees today that man is responsible for nothing and can help nothing. But Brandon up there, it suddenly occurs to you, is saying that isn't true. It's not true that man is a helpless pawn of fate or circumstances. But everybody says he is. Why the devil should I have to decide? I better get out of here. And so you go out of focus and cease to hear me. That would be three examples, all dramatizations of the choice to think or not to think. Now, it is very important in understanding the principle of volition and how it works to distinguish this basic choice to focus one's mind and to think from the question of what sort of things one will choose to think about. Because obviously the sort of things one will choose to think about in any day or week or month will depend upon a wide variety of factors, one's interests, one's values, one's context, one's problems, etc., and so forth. They are not chosen as primary acts of free choice, meaning that if on any given day you wake up and you decide to be in full focus, that is what volition directly pertains to. the decision to be in full focus. But, assuming you are in full focus, you don't decide in that primary same way, in a vacuum, so to speak, what you will think about, because obviously in any given day you have a context, you have continuous problems, you have a life, you have interests, you have values, etc. and so forth, and they will obviously be relevant to what you will choose to think about. Let's give an example. I wake up early this morning, and I focus, and I habitually ask myself, well, what's the program or the agenda for today? What am I going to be concerned with today? And within a second, what comes into my mind is that I am writing an article for the Objectivist newsletter, and that I must finish it by a certain date, and I remember that there are certain tricky problems, and when I stopped working yesterday, I was stuck on something, and there are problems I have to solve today and get on with the job. And as I'm getting up and shaving and brushing my teeth, my mind is going to the article when I'll be at my desk in a few minutes and remembering where I left off yesterday, and perhaps I'm imagining different ways I could try to express such and such a thought. Well, once I am in focus, it's very natural I find my mind going particularly, specifically to the subject of that article, since that right now is my immediate concern. I don't say to myself in a vacuum, well, today now then, what shall I think about my article or deep sea diving, or polo, perhaps, or crab fishing? Well, that would be absurd, wouldn't it? All of those other choices are not primary choices. They're not direct three choices. They obviously depend upon a great many antecedent factors, to repeat, your values, your problems, your context, etc. and so forth. Now, there is a question which I am often asked about this choice to think or not to think, and which I would like to discuss with you. Students will often ask me some variant of this question. Doesn't a man have to be thinking already in order to choose to think? If you're not thinking already, how do you choose to think? And there's a certain confusion in that question which I want to clarify, and in clarifying it, I think will throw more light on this whole concept of volition. As I have said, the primary choice to think, that is, to focus one's mind, to set it to the purpose of active cognitive integration, must be distinguished from any other category of choice. It must be distinguished from the decision to think about a particular subject, which depends on one's values, interests, knowledge, and context. And again, it must be distinguished from the decision to perform a particular physical action, which again depends on one's values, interests, knowledge, and context. These decisions obviously involve complex causal antecedents of a kind which the choice to focus does not. A man's choice to focus is a primary. It's a psychological primary, a first cause within man's consciousness. The principle that man is a being of volitional consciousness has reference specifically, of course, as I have indicated, to the human form of consciousness, that is, to the conceptual level of awareness. The perceptual level which man shares with animals is automatic. To be aware of the physical concretes of his immediate sensory field, man merely has to be awake, assuming, of course, a normal brain state. But to engage in an active process of cognitive integration, to abstract, conceptualize, relate, infer, to reason, man must focus his mind. He must set it to the task of active integrating. This level of awareness must be achieved and maintained volitionally. Now, here is a very important thought. The act of focusing pertains to the operation of the faculty of consciousness, to its method of functioning, not to its content. I want to repeat that statement. The act of focusing pertains to the operation of the faculty of consciousness, to its method of functioning, not to its content. To understand the process of focusing, I must discuss briefly with you the concept of levels of awareness. A consciousness can function on different levels of awareness. This concept refers to the degree of active cognitive integration in which a mind is engaged. How actively is the mind seeking to grasp everything within its range, to assimilate it, to identify it? What sort of factors will reflect varying levels of consciousness or degrees of clarity or awareness? First of all, one, the clarity or the vagueness of the mind's contents. The higher the level of awareness, the clearer the mental contents. The lower the level of awareness, the vaguer, the more dim, unclear the mental contents. Two, the degree to which the mind's activity involves abstractions or principles versus the degree to which it's concrete bound and is tied only to immediately present concretes. It's a higher level of awareness to think in terms of abstractions and principles than to see only that which is staring you directly in front of your nose. And three, the level of awareness is reflected in the degree to which the relevant wider context is present or absent in the process of thinking. That is, when you are thinking about a given problem, do you hold the full context in which this problem exists? Do you seek to recall and to apply everything relevant that could possibly help you to know how to deal with this? Or do you look at the problem as though you were born 1 minute before and knew nothing? And you forget all of your past knowledge and all of your past experience and try to deal with the problem as though your brain literally had begun to work only 1 minute ago. That, again, will determine the level of awareness, the level of mental advancement on which one functions. Thus, you see, there are degrees of awareness, degrees of consciousness. The alternative is not simply absolute unconsciousness or optimal consciousness. The choice to focus or to think does not consist of moving from a state of literal unconsciousness to a state of consciousness. This clearly would be impossible. When one is asleep, one cannot suddenly choose to start thinking. To focus is to move from a lower level of consciousness to a higher level. To move from mental passivity to purposeful mental activity. To initiate a process of directed cognitive integration. In a state of passive or relatively passive awareness, a man can apprehend the need to be in full mental focus. His choice is then to evade that knowledge or to exert the effort of raising the level of his awareness. Just as focusing involves expanding the range of one's awareness, so evasion consists of the reverse process, of shrinking the range of one's awareness. Evasion, meaning the blind refusal to think, the rejection of that which you know or could know, evasion takes the form of refusing to raise the level of one's awareness when one knows, clearly or dimly, that one should, or of lowering the level of one's awareness when one knows that one shouldn't. I want to repeat that very important statement. Evasion takes the form of refusing to raise the level of one's awareness when one knows, clearly or dimly, that one should, or of lowering the level of one's awareness when one knows that one shouldn't. When a man acts and functions with his mind unfocused, we may, in certain contexts, refer to him as unconscious. This is a means of indicating that such a man is existing on a level of awareness inadequate to the requirements of human survival. That is, he is attempting to exist in a state inadequate to the cognition of reality which human survival requires. He is attempting, in effect, to exist on the passive perceptual level that is appropriate to a lower animal. But this is a specialized use of the term unconscious. For example, if you see a person acting without thinking, you might say to him, "For heaven's sake, be conscious." Well, you don't mean literally that he's unconscious. What you mean is he's not conscious enough. He's existing on a very vague, diffuse, low level of consciousness, utterly inadequate to the task in which he is engaged. Speaking literally, of course, when a man is awake and his brain and nervous system are structurally normal, he is conscious, if only passively. This basic level of consciousness is given to him by nature, as it were. Volition pertains to the responsibility of raising this basic level to the active conceptual level which is appropriate to man. This, then, in very general outline, is what the principle that man is a being of volitional consciousness means. Man is a being who must direct his consciousness to an appropriate level, that is, appropriate to the tasks required of reality. That does not happen automatically. Man must control that mental process. Now, when we say that man normally has the power to think or not to think, to exercise this basic choice, this basic type of self-regulatory action, I must emphasize that one always speaks in the context of a normal brain. One always speaks in the context of a normal being. Now, one very small point of clarification that might otherwise, if I omitted this, be a question for some of you. You might ask two points, but isn't it sometimes harder to think than other times, as, for example, when you're tired? Yes, indeed it is. And here we deal with a partly physical factor. Obviously, if you've been up all night, it's harder to concentrate at 7 o'clock in the morning if you haven't been to sleep yet than if you had been to sleep for 10 preceding hours. But this is obviously a physical factor, and one assumes normal conditions. What you do have the power to know, if you have been up for 24 hours, is that you are awfully tired, that you are finding it excruciatingly difficult to think clearly, and therefore that this is not the time to make any crucial decisions. That is the form in which you still remain adequately conscious. You remain conscious enough to know what your own state is and that you had best go to bed. Or again, suppose it happens that a person is immensely upset over something very painful or distressing or agitating which has happened. Well, here again, his responsibility consists of knowing that he is in that state. I am not saying that he necessarily has to or will always be able to think as clearly. Some people can to a remarkable extent, however, but I am not saying that he must always or be expected to think as clearly when he is upset as when he is not upset. But he has to be aware of the fact that he is upset, and if he feels himself that agitated and distraught, then in fact he has to say to himself and or to anybody with whom he is dealing, give me a chance to quiet down a little bit and pull myself together, and then I will begin to think about this subject or answer you or do whatever is appropriate. He still has to remain aware and can remain aware volitionally of what his own internal state is. And in that sense, that is a form of choosing to think, of recognizing in this case what your own state is, and again, of not speaking when one should remain silent and possibly say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing.